All primates, including humans, are highly visual creatures. It's the primary sense that we rely on for finding our food, assessing potential mates, constructing shelter, and we also rely on vision for more complex behaviors like caring for children and making friends. Evolution has gotten human brains to the place where at least 50% and maybe more of our cortex is devoted to processing visual information. The brain structure remains the same whether a person sees well or whether a person is visually impaired or blind. And on this show, I've got to admit so far, even though as a podcast, we are a sound-based medium, most of the topics are visual in some way. At some point, it was the eyes of a scientist or architect or artist that observed or learned things we discuss here. That's one reason why I'm very excited about today's guest, to make up for this sensory inequality. Today's episode isn't about taste, not yet anyway, or touch or smell, but it is about the sense we humans rely upon second most often. Welcome to The Shape of the World. I'm Jill Riddell.
Hello, I'm David George Haskell, author of Sounds Wild and Broken, Sonic Marvels, Evolution's Creativity, and the Crisis of Sensory Extinction. I am also a professor at the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee.
Welcome to The Shape of the World. I'm so glad you can be here.
Thank you, Jill. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
How do you describe the book Sounds Wild and Broken? If someone hasn't yet touched it or seen it, maybe somebody who never got around to reading The Songs of Trees when that was so popular and everybody was always asking me whether I'd read it or not. There was that time period when it seemed like everyone had a copy by their bedside. But how do you describe the book to someone who's not familiar with your work?
Well, the book is a celebration of the diversity of sounds in our world today. I also explore how those sounds came to be the way they are. I also ask, where does human music and language fit within the larger music and languages of the world?
Whenever I have read your work, I have had this experience that reminds me a little bit of when I go into a room and I've forgotten what it was that I went in there for, and then suddenly I remember and it turns out that it's something really important. And so much of my own mental activity often seems to be about tuning out the sounds that I hear. I live in a city. It's important to be able to have that capacity just to be able to function. But when you remind me of the sounds, I feel that same kind of jolt of, that's what I came here to pay attention to, the sounds.
Now, that's wonderful that you have that response. Thank you. And yeah, as you point out, we live in a world with lots of sensory stimuli coming at us all the time. And so in order to function, either to focus or just to defend ourselves from the too muchness of the world, we have to shut things out. Often those things are sounds, because sound goes around and through obstacles. So we have a practice of defending ourselves, of closing. Then we also then need a practice of, when it's safe and when it's appropriate, of opening the senses back up to the world, to listen, to smell, to feel the tactile delights of the world.
Yes.
We need to reopen. And then after attending to the senses, follow some of those stories. And this is the delight, I think, in listening, is that there's pleasure in connecting to the pure physicality of sound and getting beyond judgment of sound. And then querying the stories behind the sounds that we're hearing. And sometimes those stories are of great beauty, but often they are also of brokenness and fracture. But the primary practice is, first of all, to listen.
Well, you really bring that home so beautifully. And I also just love the physical description that you had of how sound came into being from these small little cilia. Do you mind describing a little bit about what it is that's happening and how it is that, why there even is sound? That was such an interesting part of the book.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. Sound is a phenomenon that exists in the universe independent of whether there is any creature listening. So in fact, there were sound waves, pressure waves in the plasma of the early cosmos before even atoms existed. This plasma was so hot and compressed that atoms couldn't exist. They sort of melted into protons and electrons, and light was trapped inside. those sound waves actually still flowing through the universe now in the cosmic microwave background radiation. So sound long predates planet Earth. When the Earth formed, the primordial sounds of Earth are some of the sounds we can still hear today in places where we don't have a lot of human noise or the noise of other living beings. Waves lapping on the shore, thunder, lightning, rain tumbling onto rock. When life evolved, life started to make sound waves, little pressure waves in the water and a little bit in the air, but mostly in the water, through the vibrations on the surface of bacteria. And very early on, creatures became sensitive to those sounds and evolved rudimentary ways of hearing. Those rudimentary ways of hearing are still the cellular structures that we use in much more sophisticated organs today. Tiny little hairs on the outside of cells. For single-celled creatures living in a pond or out in the ocean, those hairs just poke out into the environment and pick up pressure waves. In our human body, they're located in a coil of water inside our ears, what we call the inner ear, the cochlea. And the job of the rest of the ears is to take sound pressure waves in air and convert them into little aquatic trembles and shimmers that these hair cells can pick up.
And is this the same for dogs and cats and, I don't know, marmots? Are all animals hearing the same way we do?
Other animals use the hairs, but in different ways. Insects have the hairs lodged into sensors in the joints of their legs, in the base of their antennae, and little hearing drums in their legs in some species. So although the listening, the organs of hearing take very different forms in different branches of the animal kingdom, of the evolutionary tree of life, they're all grounded in this fundamental unity. And that's one of the great things, I think, about biology. There's always a tension between unity and diversity, just as there is in human music, right? Themes and variations, the ways that we hear, or the way that the skin is structured, or the way that sounds are evoked from sound-making devices, take multifarious forms but often have an underlying unity.
What were your early experiences of sound as a little tiny organism new to the earth yourself? Do you remember any times when perhaps you heard a sound and maybe discovered its cause on your own?
An early sound that really struck me, a memory that struck me actually quite strongly as I was writing this book, I happened to be in Paris visiting some family and had rented an Airbnb for a couple of nights. And a European blackbird was singing in the courtyard outside behind this apartment. And its sound was echoing off the walls of the courtyard. And I heard that sound and I was transported back to my childhood. Because when I was 3-4 years old, my family lived in an apartment in Paris with an echoey courtyard behind. And the only bird that would sing in the spring was this blackbird. And I actually didn't have a conscious memory of this, but the acoustic experience took me back to my childhood. And then my parents told me, oh yeah, when you were a kid, that was a sound that we heard. And then for my mother in particular, she grew up in the English countryside where there were many, many more bird sounds than just one blackbird singing in a courtyard. So for her, it was a sound, a poignant sound, because there were a lot of species missing. For me, it became one of these, this sort of internal compass that sounds like home. And we all have these things, sounds that we heard early on in life. We remember, and we have amazing acoustic long-term memory, unlike many other primates, say chimpanzees and gorillas. They have great memories for many things, but long-term memory of sound is not one of them. And that may be related to the fact that our language, spoken language, is so sophisticated that it creates this deep acoustic memory. So a European blackbird singing in a courtyard is one of those early sonic experiences that's particularly meaningful for me.
When I read about that in your book, it reminded me of an experience from my own childhood where I, although I've lived in cities for many years now, I grew up on the edge of a forest. And one evening I began to hear a sound of a wood thrush. And the wood thrush has this wonderful warbling song. And it didn't sound like anything else. And for me, I think the reason that it was so clear to me is that it felt like an act of discovery, because nobody had ever pointed it out to me as being something beautiful. Nobody had ever said, listen to that. It felt like it was just a direct communication between the wood thrush and me.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And the wood thrush in particular, it's such a rich, rich song that is pitched and is at a tempo that is sort of matched to the human ear. And so Sounds of Birds reminds us of the great interconnectedness of the world, that our personal experiences depend on habitats spread all over the Americas.
It really does. So at this point, I feel obliged to tell you something, which is that David and I recorded this conversation in the early spring of 2022, and I don't know why we held this episode to release until now, but we just did. And now it's December, and I ought to be doing a show about Christmas trees or something, but yeah. What I'm going to say next in this interview is going to make you think that tulips are about to start blooming. Just didn't want to make you confused. So any day now in Chicago, I'm expecting to hear my first white-crowned sparrow of the season. We get them in the backyards of where we live. And in the book, you told the story about how the white-crowned sparrow's song has changed to compensate for city noise. Can you describe that?
Yeah, so these sparrows are extraordinary learners. The sparrows in different parts of the country have different dialects. It's not because of a genetic difference mostly, but because they've learned different song types, and so there are dialects and accents and a form of bird vocal culture that as we travel around the country, we can tune our ears to the different lingo of the birds, the different cadences and timbres of birds. And when these sparrows find themselves in the city, and here this is research that Elizabeth Derryberry and her colleagues have done over many years in the Bay Area, they've shown an adaptation of these birds to the sonic environment of the city. And the COVID pandemic, with the shutdown and the traffic stopped and the noise of the city really diminished briefly, they found that the birds reverted to their songs of back from decades ago. So how is the song of a white-crowned sparrow different in the city? They sing generally at a higher frequency. They lop off the lower parts of their songs. Why is that? That's because that's where all the great rumble of traffic and industry creates a dark cloud of sound, and the birds can't be heard through that. So they don't waste their energy putting any sound out from their own songs in that area. So, and this is not just a story about white-crowned sparrows. This has been shown over and over again for birds living in cities all around the world. They get higher-pitched. They also tend to get louder because, and in fact, getting louder is likely the primary adaptation to the city. When you're in a noisy place, you sing louder. And humans do the same thing, where when we're in noisy environments, we speak at higher frequencies and louder. Interestingly, right. The white-crowned sparrows in the Bay Area compensate for the lack of virtuosity in their urban-adapted songs. So by lopping off the bottom of the scale, they've lost the ability to show how rapidly they can go from low frequency to high frequency and back again. You know, that was a way of showing off how good they were. They can't do that anymore because city noise has wiped out that possibility. Instead, they've added other ornaments and accents and things to kind of spice things up a little bit. So the birds have not just changed the loudness and the frequency of their songs, but also the internal structure to adapt the song and its social meanings to these new sounds of the city.
That's so interesting that there could be these regional accents and these differences based on topography, geography, and human population levels. And how smart, right? How adaptive.
Yeah, I mean, birds have been around for 150 million years, so they're doing something right. They made it through.
They've got a few tricks up their sleeve.
Yeah, you know, and actually think about deep time and birds. The first birds to evolve actually probably did not sound anything like the ones we have now. The syrinx, which is the structure in the chest of birds, which birds use to make their sounds now, evolved late, about 68, 69 million years ago. And the first birds were around 155 million years ago. So it took a while. And the early diversification of birds, they were probably croaking and whistling the way modern reptiles do now. Then the syrinx evolved. And the syrinx was one of those structures that made it through the mass extinction. A few at the end of the Cretaceous period, big meteorite struck the Earth, wiped out most of the Earth's forest, wiped out most of the Earth's birds as well. And those that made it through happened to be the ones who were good singers. And now when we hear birdsong, we're hearing the legacy of the renewal after this enormous loss. So if we re-ran the tape of life again, as Stephen Jay Gould used to say about other time periods of life, perhaps birds wouldn't sing the way they do now. You know, a different group of birds would have made it through the mass extinction, and they'd just be wheezing and squeaking and bellowing the way alligators and geckos and turtles do today.
That's just amazing to think about. And it also is amazing to think about how encoded these things are through centuries, through eons, really. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about the phenomenon of migration in Chicago. Chicago's right on the flyway. We have 7 million some birds that come right through here at this time of year. But of course, for them, the city just happens to be in the pathway. It's not like they're trying to fly into Chicago or any of its big airports. They just, you know, it just happens to lie on the same path that they've been taking for all of this really long period of time.
Yeah, and particularly with Chicago being on the shore there, a lot of migrant birds use those shorelines as ways of navigating, you know, where is north and south, but also rich food sources, at least historically, all along those places where water and land meet are very ecologically rich. And so the birds are very much tuned into that as they continue their migration. Coastlines are especially important for migratory corridors.
So you've used the term sensory diversity and suggest in the book that this is another loss that we're suffering, a loss of sensory diversity. Can you explain what you mean by that term?
Yeah, so sensory diversity is the range of different sonic manifestations in the world. So a spring peepa frog sounds really different than a whooping crane, which sounds different from a cicada, which sounds really different from a field cricket. And then if we look just within a single group of birds, like the sparrows, or a group of insects, different cicadas have really different sounds. That's the diversity of sensory expression. One could do the same thing for aroma or for visual signals. Of course, every sense has its own form of diversity. And the interesting thing about sensory diversity is that the senses are the means by which organisms connect one to another. And that connection is generative. So when we're talking here, new ideas may emerge in the conversation. Or when females and males are displaying to one another, say, if they're frogs in a swamp, there is possibility for innovation, for adaptation to the environment, for new forms of sexual selection. And all of these evolutionary and ecological processes are catalyzed by sensory connection between creatures. So sensory diversity is not just a manifestation of the diversity of life. It is one of the generative powers of life as well. When you take away connection, creativity and resilience and possibility go down. So this is one of the reasons why I think sensory diversity is, first of all, so glorious. It connects us to the act of creation in a biological sense. And also why attention to it is part of the conservation and environmental conversation is that if sensory diversity is diminished, if sensory connections are removed, we're losing something very important to the vitality of the world.
And what's causing a decline in sensory diversity?
Well, sensory diversity is being lost in one way by too much noise from humans. So in cities, but also in the oceans, we are pumping so much human-generated sound into the environment that many species cannot hear one another. So their social networks are falling apart as a direct consequence of us, mostly our engines and industry, and in the oceans, seismic exploration and sonar, as well as shipping noise, creating a living hell for creatures that are very acoustically sensitive. For example, many plankton and fish and shrimps and marine mammals, the level of noise is such that their bodies are actually being directly physically harmed in some cases. So that's too much noise is one way. Another is sort of paradoxically a loss of noise. When we modify habitats either directly through felling forests or turning prairies into agricultural monocultures, or indirectly through all the various impacts of climate change on land and in the oceans and in fresh water, we're reducing sensory diversity that way. And you can hear this. You can hear that a monoculture plantation just sounds completely different than the diverse habitat that was there before. So that's another form of sensory loss. Speaking just from a human perspective, a third form of loss is just inattention. There may be lots of sounds around, but we are more and more species that directs its attention inward to the voices of our own species, to the exclusion of other creatures in the living earth. And that is a loss for us because this is a great source of beauty and joy and a source of renewal in challenging times to pay attention to the living world. But it's also a source of loss for the vitality and future of the planet, because when the most powerful species on the planet, us, stops listening, that relationship isn't going to go well. Just like if I stop listening to my family, my friends, lovers, those relationships are not going to go very well if I'm not listening. Same thing if I'm not listening to the voices of my kin, the birds and the trees and the living rivers and the whales and neighbors. These are both kin and neighbors. How can I expect to be a good relative? How can I expect to be a good member of the living earth community if I'm not listening?
Right. And if you barely even know that they're there, you had a really nice phrase where you said that the fundamental unit of biology is the relationship. It sounds like that's very close to what you're saying now. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
Yeah. For about 150 years in biology, we have been saying and have taught our students, this is certainly how I was taught, that the fundamental unit of life is the individual. It's a very atomistic view of life. The individual gene, the individual organism, the individual species. And that view of individuality is very powerful and very fruitful. A lot of Darwinian evolutionary theory, a lot of ecological theory, studies of genes have been powered by this notion of the individual being fundamental. However, that view is at best limited. My opinion is it's actually just wrong in that the individual, yes, an individual is important, but individuals are manifestations of connection and of relationship. What persists through time are relationships and interconnections. My body is a temporary manifestation of interconnection through genealogical lines of genes meeting together in my body. The microbiome that's on and in me, and I'm a walking, living community, just as trees are and every other being in the world. And so when we reframe our thoughts about what is the stuff of life into thinking about relationships and interconnection, it doesn't get rid of evolutionary theory or ecology or genetics. It allows us new ways of asking questions in those areas. In my books, I really emphasize relationship because I think that's one of the revolutions that's happening in biology now. We're waking up to seeing what an amazing worldview this is.
So thinking this way and understanding what you understand about the interactions between all things and the fact that you yourself are essentially an ecosystem that's walking around that has all of these other organisms that are living within you or on your skin, does that change anything for you in how you perceive yourself? Do you, in your own inner monologue that we all have in our heads, do you think of yourself as a we rather than simply an I?
The nature of the inner monologue for most people is to be an I, but the inner monologue is lying to us. The texture of that monologue, say whether we feel happy or sad, is a product partly of our gut bacteria speaking to our brain through one of the vagus nerves. Also, in just in terms of human psychology, we are a fragmented, ever-changing set of ideas and interconnections in our brains. And so the notion that there is a singular I within that is pretty hard to defend on a neurobiological level as well. It is useful and to think that way, and that's probably why our consciousness is structured that way, is that to imagine ourselves at all times as a multiplicity would be very hard to get through the day and get things done. Agency, for example, works best when it is knotted around particular centers of action and focus. It's that's how humans think. And just so it's in a way, it's a playful realization that I'm living in a kind of delusion the whole time,
right,
which I think is a call to a certain measure of humility. If I can be deluded about something as fundamental as the nature of my own consciousness and being, what else might I be deluded about? And the answer is an awful lot of things, including, for example, our need to name and summarize things. Look out the window. Oh, that's a white oak or a sugar maple. Well, those singular names are lies, because the white oak is comprised of hundreds of species of bacteria and fungi and tree cells and nematodes and mites, all working together, mostly cooperatively, some of them parasitically. An enormous complex community that we call a tree. Now, I continue to teach my students that's a white oak, but with a grain of salt, because this is a shorthand, and realize that it's a shorthand that obscures the nature of things. And it's also a shorthand that's very convenient for a destructive economy, a destructive globalized economy, because when things are thought of as individuals and as units, they're easier to objectify and put outside ourselves. If I think of the tree as partly made of me, I'm less likely to regard that tree as a dead object rather than as an extension of the relationship that sustains me. So this language and self-conception, I think, is tricky, and it leads ultimately to ethics. How do we think of ourselves in relation to the so-called other?
Well, you draw those connections so beautifully in your books. You've been able to write so globally and find these connections between us and the living world. And it was reminding me of a story. So years ago, I worked for the Nature Conservancy, and I was on the phone with a colleague who was a very interesting person, sort of a self-taught scientist who had taken it upon himself to learn the insect populations in a prairie that he was very interested in by capturing the insects and bringing them home in jars and listening to their songs at night so that he could recognize their songs when he was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he dedicated himself to memorizing the insect songs. But he was under a lot of pressure because he'd gotten a job now at managing that prairie. But he was under a lot of pressure because it was owned by a university to get a PhD. And I think he was probably the kind of person who probably hadn't liked college all that much to begin with. And here he was in a PhD program. And I remember his saying to me that biology departments, or at least his biology department, he said, they shame the love of animals right out of you. And the focus is really on not just an individual animal, but an individual molecule. And molecular biology was really all the rage. It was the only place that there were any jobs. And it was very hard for you to boldly go in to a biology department and say, I love animals and mm-hmm. I want to study animals. And I'm thinking a little bit about your path, because you were trained as a zoologist and you started in a traditional way in a biology department. And it does seem like you've managed to go beyond thinking about something very tiny and making your mark in studying something tiny. And I'm not dissing that. There's a place for that for sure. But I do feel like there's sometimes what you are doing in drawing the connections among vast things, vast connections between entire forests and all the organisms within the forest and their relationship with us and how we're one, that's something that's sometimes frowned upon in traditional mm-hmm. biology departments. How did you manage to find your way to doing what you're doing?
A lot of thoughts evoked by that beautiful story there. Yeah, the first is imagine if every middle schooler was set that task, go catch some insects and learn their sounds, with the goal of every, say, 15-year-old in the United States in every school system has learned the 20 sounds of common species, whether it's birds or crickets or frogs, whatever it is, rather than just a bunch of ideas that live in the mind only. And that when you go outside, your senses are not connected to what you've been doing in the classroom. In biology education, there are a series of filters that keep people with deep sense of empathy for other human beings out. You dissect the rats, you cut open the living worms and the living snails, you impose, and so anyone who can't deal with that, it's like, well, I'm going to drop biology because I don't want to do that. Right? Or stick a rod in through the brain of a living frog to so-called pith it so you can do a physiological experiment on it. Yeah, I mean, these are sort of widespread practices. What does that do for biology? It means only the people who can turn off their feelings or who have already objectified the world are going to be attracted and will stay within the field. All the others are excluded. So people whose nervous systems are tuned in ways that make them extremely empathetic, sensitive to pain, cannot get degrees in biology. Now, that was particularly true 20 years ago. I think is less so now because everything is just online now. And even the idea of studying a whole organism, let alone cutting it up, is out of fashion in many biology departments. But there is a way in which there's a training in cruelty and a training in objectification. At least that's my opinion. My colleagues would strongly disagree, I think, with that. Let me be clear. I do think there is a role for experiments that and educational experiences that involve the death of non-human animals. But I think that place for those is much, much smaller than what we do in our society now. In my own path, I found these things very hard. The minute I got any power over my own teaching, which luckily was fairly early in grad school, my rule has been I will not kill anything to teach. It doesn't mean that other people might not be justified in doing that. But for example, when I taught ornithology, I had the students dissect birds, but they were all roadkill birds. And people in town would know that, oh yeah, if you see a dead owl, I mean, it's very sad, but if you see a dead owl on the road or a sparrow hits your window, take it to Haskell and he'll put it in the freezer and bring it out for the students. So in my own path as a teacher, I've tried to lean into offering experiences that are about connecting with the world that don't involve going out and killing things or experimenting on them. I used to do bird banding with undergrad students where you catch birds in nets and put rings on them. And that, you know, it's perfectly legitimate scientific practice. But I found that particularly with undergrads who had no experience with this, I was just imposing too much pain on these birds in a way that I thought, well, we can connect to the birds in other ways. We don't have to hold them in our hands and utterly freak them out and soak their bodies in stress hormones just so that a student can hold a bird in the hand, although I realize that holding a bird in the hand can be a transformative experience. What I do instead is we go out and we listen. So we hold them in our mind. We get up close to them when we're observing outside. So I do try and provide rich sensory immersive experiences, but that are standing back from messing with the animals. Of course, part of my writing, a lot of the sort of philosophical underpinning is about asking the question, what does it mean to belong here and to be in right relationship with other species? And I'm hoping that the essays, the books, open the door to people who are interested in science to say, oh, I can be like this. And I've had grad students, for example, write and say, thank you for putting that book out there. Because in my lab, if I even mention, say, that I'm doing meditation, which is hardly like a radical thing in our society today, I'm considered just like, woo-woo, you've gone off the deep end, all the rest of it. It's not like you're showing up and saying, I'm a fundamentalist, and I believe that the Earth was created a few thousand years ago out of nothing, and evolution is nonsense. I mean, that, you know, that's a pretty hard thing to defend in a biology lab. But the notion of just being quiet two times a day and watching your breath, that is some kind of radical departure from the foundations of biology, that seems like philosophically unjustifiable. So there is a room for rigor, for curiosity, for experimentation, as well as for open-ended contemplative admiration of the world. And I think that rigor is present right at the roots of modern biology. What did Charles Darwin do? You know, bring in the patriarch here, the dead white male, to justify everything. He would walk around and around this, essentially what we would call now walking meditation, where he could just chill, let his thoughts come together, ruminate over things in a way that is extremely meditative. And of course, he had a very open-ended and very curious mind, grabbing hold of all sorts of things from his environment and then trying to put them together. So I do think we have some, even within the lineage of modern biology, we have some great examples, as well as people, of course, from the more literary side, people like Annie Dillard, who brought in contemplative ways of honoring the natural history and the ecology of the world, but using that as a way to ask more philosophical questions. Our teaching should be open enough to encompass all different forms of enthusiasm for the rest of life.
Right. As you're talking about that, I'm thinking about how my high school biology class very much was about the test of a steely will, where you started with dissection of a frog, and then near the end of your first year of biology, you'd dissect a fetal pig. And now that you're saying that, I'm thinking that it's no wonder there weren't more women scientists, that everybody who declined to dissect the fetal pig in the classroom was female, and how those kinds of tests are put up in people's way, that you have to be able to turn yourself off in some to the suffering of others in some way that's not so different from asking men to go to war, which requires that they will turn themselves off to the suffering of others and do what needs to be done. And all of this is just making me think also about your part in the section of the book that's about cities, where you describe noise as being gendered, that by and large, men make noise, and it's their inventions that make noise. And what do you think about that? Is noise gendered?
Noise in many contexts is. I mean, look at, and I should talk here, obviously, there are many cultures around the world. And so what I'm going to say now is applying to the culture I know best, which is a sort of Western industrialized culture. But in our culture, noisy young men are lauded and encouraged for their vigor and their noisiness and so on. And young women are shushed. Now, how does this manifest in the city? Go out on the city street. Who is it who is driving by with modified pipes on their truck or their motorbike? Sometimes modified to the point of where if you drive that vehicle down the road, it will set off every car alarm parked along the street there because of the shockwave of the sound coming down it. So in the practice of noisemaking in the city, it's the majority of that noise is coming from men. But if we look deeper than that and ask, why is the city arranged the way it is? Why are some neighborhoods, particularly Black neighborhoods and low-income neighborhoods, why are they the ones that had interstate highways routed through them, creating a deep environmental injustice of noise and air pollution in some neighborhoods and not others? Those were men making those decisions. And in fact, the federal government, until relatively recently, provided a direct subsidy for that, 90% cost share to cities to build interstates and so on that were mostly routed through, quote, ghettos to clean out the ghettos. And Moses, who was one of the people who involved in this in New York City, the sort of the great power broker up there of the reconfiguring of the city so that cars could be more ubiquitous in New York, absolutely had a clear policy of a classist and racist policy of directing noise into some neighborhoods and not others. So not only is noise gendered, but the inequities of the burden of noise emerge from a gendered space as well. This is not to claim that women are by nature silent or anything like that. It's to say we live in a culture where women's voices have been pushed back and suppressed, and men's voices have been encouraged in that noisemaking.
Do you think it's fair to say that it's more fun to be the one making a loud noise than it is to be the one hearing the loud noise? I'm thinking it's almost like smoking. Like back in the day when people smoked cigarettes, it was much more tolerable if you smoked a cigarette yourself than just to be the constant recipient of somebody else's smoke. And I think that there's something about noise that's like that too, that it's fun to make a really loud noise, to have a big impact on your environment in some way. Less fun to be the passive recipient of it.
Well, yeah, and one definition of noise, you know, what is the difference between noise and other forms of sound? One definition is that noise is unwanted and uncontrollable sound, so it exists outside our agency. And those noises can be loud, but, you know, that unwanted sound could be the sound of a dripping pipe in your neighbor's apartment. It's not particularly loud on the decibel scale, but it may be driving you crazy because they won't fix their plumbing. And so, yeah, that asymmetry. In a way, that is the point of making some of that noise. And the biggest noisemakers tend to be the young males who have the least power in society and feel the most pushed down upon. Because how do you reassert your presence in the world when everyone tells you you're worth nothing, when the whole political system is set up against you and is setting you to fail? How do you reassert yourself in that world? Well, one way is to go out and make some noise. So, I mean, you can understand from a psychological point of view, you can understand where some of this is coming from, but it doesn't make it any easier for the people who are the recipients of this. We deliberately immerse ourselves in loud noises when we go to concerts, or when we just crank up the stereo ourselves when we're driving, or when we're in a springtime swamp and the spring peepers are so loud that it's literally making our ears ring. That's a joyful sound. But the key thing there is I choose to go there. Noise, by most people's definitions, are the things that we don't choose and cannot get away from.
And of course, when we hear a sound, we're literally being touched by the object making that sound. I mean, we have a physical connection between us. It's not touched with a fingertip, but there is something from that human being or from that other organism or from two physical objects out in the world colliding with one another that's literally touching us through the sound waves. Is that right?
Yeah, the pressure waves are I think of them as sort of neurotransmitters in the air. So when I'm speaking, I'm sending out tiny little pressure waves from my vocal folds, then get shaped by my mouth, my tongue, my lips. They go out into the world. And then I am not traveling. And in fact, the air molecules aren't. All the air molecules is doing a wiggling back and forth, transmitting the pressure wave to the next air molecule, then the next, all the way across to somebody's ears, where they then receive and interpret these things. Most insects actually do most of their hearing through their feet, hearing stuff in leaves and in wood. And aquatic creatures, of course, are hearing in water. I think aroma is the most direct in that aromatic molecules leave, say, when I'm smelling a flower. The aroma leaves the flower, is actually produced in the flower's cells. That actual molecule drifts through the air and then binds to molecules in my nose, and then that triggers a nerve impulse. Quite literally, some of that flower aroma has bound to me. I am partly made of flower. So, you know, different senses have different ways of connecting us, and you know, each one has its sort of imaginative delights.
That's so beautiful. Is there a sound that other people consider unattractive and unappealing that you secretly really like? Like, is there a something tacky that you actually really like the sound of?
I love mostly the convergence of sounds that you can hear in the city. And actually, for a while, I had this project of going around recording places where human motion and the motion of water intersected in interesting ways. So a dripping drain pipe right next to a subway train, or a fountain with kids playing around it and then car horns honking around it. So different forms of convergence I find actually very, very fascinating.
You know, as I was getting ready for this, I was thinking about how the soundscape in the city that I live in has improved in many ways with the elimination of car alarms. So car alarms were something that really dominated things in the late part of the 20th century until makers of cars got to the place where you had to have a key that communicated with the engine directly and the car couldn't be turned on without that relationship. They created a relationship that kept it from being stolen. That was such a prominent part of my young adulthood living in the city that really has gone. and cars in general are quieter than they used to be. Then obviously muffler laws, but even beyond that, engines are quieter than they once were. Even the sound of doors closing, they don't quite slam the way giant steel doors did. I'm also thinking within the home, things like exhaust fans and dishwashers. You can buy ones that are relatively silent. So there are people that are paying attention to it. I ran across an organization that I think might have even been mentioned in something of yours, but there is an organization in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's called something like Noise Free America. Do you feel that there's somewhat of a trend, or is it just the same amount of people that have always wanted human sounds to be quieter? Or do you think there is a trend toward people caring more about noise and trying to just be more discerning of it, not necessarily shutting all noises down, but mm-hmm. perhaps trying to not just have spurious noise for no reason?
Yeah, I think, one other example of the way in which things have really radically changed is airplanes now are way, way quieter than they used to be. Mm-hmm. Like orders of magnitude quieter. However, the volume of airplane travel has gone way, way up. And the same thing with the number of miles that we're driving. So we got mostly quieter vehicles, but there are more of them. But mostly we don't know how much sound there is in the world because we haven't cared. And there is no long-term monitoring the way there is for many other sort of environmental things, like the amount of particulate pollution in the air. And in the oceans, unambiguously, things are getting worse and worse and worse. Noise is going up decade by decade. We are pumping ungodly amounts of seismic exploration noise. These air guns that go off in big arrays all around the oceans every 10 seconds for months and months on end, creating a place that for some creatures is uninhabitable. So in the terrestrial realm, things are nuanced. It depends on which part of the city you live in. But the oceans is the place where, if there's one area of noise that should be addressed out of empathy for other beings, it is in the oceans. And so, yes, there is more awareness of sound, but there are also ways in which the sonic environment is becoming much more degraded. We can do something about it. The great thing about sound pollution is you stop making sound, it goes away.
Yeah.
CO2 pumped into the atmosphere, it'll take generations for that to go away. Plastic in the oceans, on land, it will take millennia for that to go away. So sound pollution is in a way, yeah, it's a problem, but it's also a problem that has clear solutions. What is lacking right now is the will to do it.
I loved that observation. I had never thought about that before until I read that in this book, that it is something that could be ended in an instant. Once the sound is gone, the sound is gone. It reminded me of efforts to create darker skies so that we can see the stars, that if there's a big power outage, problem's over, right? Mm. There's, at least it's over for the time that the power outage is going on. The stars come instantly into view. There's nothing standing between you and it. And sound being the same way, just that whole idea that it could be ended in a microsecond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, say with shipping, 10% of the ships in the ocean are making most of the sound. So re-engineering them or getting them retrofitted or replaced could make a huge difference, as could changes in propeller design, slowing a few shipping lanes down. Weaning ourselves off of oil will have the benefit of fewer seismic explorations in the ocean. Right now, we're going exactly the opposite direction. Seismic exploration is increasing. And we are still thoroughly plugged into the oil addiction.
And is that a primary source of the sound pollution in oceans?
Yes.
Is from exploration for oil specifically?
Yeah. So seismic arrays, which are arrays of air guns that go off every few seconds and they often go for weeks or months over hundreds of square miles of ocean, are happening all around wherever there's a possibility of oil down in the deep layers. And what those air guns are doing is sending sound waves down through the water into the deep sea sediments. And then they're recording the reflections that come back up from that and making these amazing three-dimensional reconstructions of what the earth is like under the bottom of the mud at the bottom of the sea. It's very cool from a geologic study point of view. Unfortunately, the way you get that data, and particularly when it's happening all over the world, is deeply damaging to marine organisms. I mean, organisms that are close to those, say the studies that show that plankton are just kind of exploded and busted up when an air gun is close to them. Whales flee the environment around them, but other things like fish don't have the option to get out of the way. And yet the industry still claims that there's no harmful effect of these seismic arrays on marine life. Some of these seismic arrays can be heard from the other side of the ocean basin if you drop a hydrophone in.
That's unbelievable. If you had the ability to wave a magic wand and change one thing about the world, what would you choose?
Well, maybe get rid of ocean noise. I mean, in the context of
that sounds like a good one.
Of sound. And, you know, and that would be through a sort of technological transformation. There are other ways of mapping the oil reserves on the ocean that don't involve quite as much sound. The other main thing that I would change is this: what's happening with tropical forests. Tropical forests are in a state of massive crisis. We're losing 4 million hectares of primary tropical forest every year. That, of course, is a massive loss of sensory diversity, massive loss of carbon stores, of clean air, of water, of potential medicines. And it's a human rights crisis because those forests are the home to many indigenous peoples.
Well, I hope somebody does give you that magic wand. I'd like for both of those things to stop as well.
Yeah, you know, the magic wand is actually should not be given to me. It should be given to the people in Indonesia and in Brazil who know the forests, who know the culture, and know the ecosystem and how the human economy and the greater community of life can be together, how both humans and non-humans can thrive. You know, as a writer, I talk about some of these issues. I visit, I talk with people. As with the limited amount of money that I have to donate, I try and find organizations that are working with local communities where the solutions will be found, rather than me saying, well, I don't know how to solve this problem. I've got ideas, but I live in a different place. And this is part of the issue, say, with past policies of the U.S. and Western Europe, is this tendency to show up in places, either as governments or as NGOs, and say, we're going to solve your problems for you, and actually create more problems, or at least create new problems that were unanticipated, rather than trusting and acting in solidarity with local leaders who have a better understanding of things. People whose communities, whose ancestors have been living there for thousands of years in some cases.
Right. You did a lot of traveling for this book, I noticed.
Actually, I did no traveling for this book because I wrote it during the pandemic. You know, I talk about Ecuador and Israel and Europe. These are all trips that I made before the book was written. And drawing on from past experience, some of it travels that are related to previous books that I've written. Some of it, say, when I'm talking about Paris, I still have family there. I grew up there. And so family visits from pre-pandemic, talking about soundscapes. And so one of the really startling things for this book was to listen to the sounds of a rainforest through my headphones when I'm sitting in a house in the American suburbs. And at first, it's like, oh, this is really cool. And then I felt utterly seasick because my body and most of my senses were immersed in one reality and, frankly, a pretty impoverished reality, because the American suburbs, the soundscapes are pretty limited and the air quality isn't great and carpet fibers under your feet. And particularly during the pandemic, hard to feel all happy and jolly about life in that situation. And then listening through my ears to the most biodiverse places in the world, layer upon layer of sound, hundreds of species all singing at once, this great magnificence of sound. So this kind of disconnect in my senses between my ears and the rest of my body. And this made me wonder, is this what the first musicians felt when they heard recorded sound coming back to them? Because until about the 1850s and 60s, all music and all human language was ephemeral. It lived on the air and then it was gone. Then we invented wax cylinders and other kinds of things to record sound. And now, of course, sound recording is like every smartphone has a pretty sophisticated sound recording device in it. We listen to recorded sound all the time. People listening to this conversation, it's recorded. You're listening to the past, people. You're listening to embers of a life that was, and that life has now moved on. And so in a way, we're creating these temporal dislocations all the time now, rather than living in the moment. Now, I'm all for recorded sounds. I listen to podcasts, audiobooks, recorded music the whole time. But this experience of dislocation made me wonder, am I missing something? Do I need to have my acoustic experience be a little bit more about the moment and a little bit less about, for example, having headphones on and walking down a street listening to music? The music is stationary because it's, you know, it's coming through my ears from a stationary source, and yet my body is in motion. No animal in the history of forever has ever experienced that before, listening to a soundscape that is utterly stationary while your body is in motion. It's just weird. And I don't understand how we can stand it, but, you know, it works. But it is a way of dissociating from the world, of fragmenting the integrated nature of our bodies. And so I think it's at least worth thinking about, what is this experience? Where might it be leading me, and where might it be leading me away from?
Right. There's something about at least being judicious about how frequently you do it and why you're doing it, and knowing that you're doing that. That seems like it bears some attention.
Yeah, paying attention, thinking about it. That's the key.
Do you have a life philosophy or a basic tenet or any motto that keeps you going?
In my work as a teacher and as a citizen and a writer, I do try to ask myself how to be on the side of beauty and connection and less on the side of disconnection and brokenness. And those are pretty broad questions, but I think they help frame, for example, the question of why am I teaching this class? What's the point of it? Or where is this book going? What's the message here? And particularly as a writer, any of us could go through and produce a book that is just all about how broken the world is. And it would be true. But I think it's also important to remember we still live on a planet that has amazing amounts of beauty in it and amazing amounts of possibility. And the great paradox and tension of our lives, both as individuals but also communally, is that tension between we live in a world that is utterly broken and that is unspeakably beautiful and inspiring. And both of those things are true at the same time. They are completely irreconcilable with one another by a rational mind. And yet, that's the world we live in. So what do we do with that? And I think one thing that the senses give us and that sort of open-ended attention to listening or any other sensory experience is it gives us a place to be in that paradox without having to try and resolve it. Mm-hmm. Practice is just pay attention, be in the moment, see where it takes you rather than trying to find the answer to this or the conclusion.
Right. To sit with that, to be an observer, to bring your awareness to it without feeling that your mind's going to explode and that if you don't hop up right now and fix the problem, that the world is going to end.
Yeah. I mean, it's a way of being in both exaltation and in grief at the same time. I mean, of course, in different times of our lives and different contexts that we're in, we're going to feel those in very different ways. And that's okay. And that's appropriate. But not losing sight of the fact that we have choice as individuals and as groups of people working together, things we can do to bring about more beauty and interconnection in the world.
Right. And that's actually what a lot of this podcast is about, is thinking about understanding what the shape of the world is and thinking about what we want the shape of the world to be.
Well, that's wonderful. And that's and I love the way shape implies a process of shaping as well. So there's a shape, the noun, and then the shaping, the verb, and the process that we're all part of. Yeah, that's beautiful.
David, thank you for being on The Shape of the World.
Thank you, Jill. Great pleasure to chat about sounds with you.
This is Jill Riddell. This episode concludes our season 5. In keeping with the time of year that we're actually in as we're releasing this episode, which is the early part of winter, the show is about to go pleasantly and delightfully dormant. just for a few months. We'll be back in the spring. I cherish the winter as a time to prepare new episodes and also to work on other writing projects. If you're a relatively new listener during this upcoming period when we're not making new episodes, please check out the archive because we're really proud of all the shows that have been made. This is the 33rd episode of The Shape of the World, so there really is a richness to be explored in those other 32 episodes. People sometimes ask me what they can do to help support The Shape of the World, and as of right now, the show isn't yet on Patreon, and we don't have a donate button on our website, so it's not super easy to do anything for us money-wise at this point, other than, I guess if you happen to know me personally, you can Venmo me or send me a check. But honestly, the most important thing you can do right now would be to write a review on the show on whichever platform you listen to it on, and for you to share this episode with two other people whom you think would enjoy it. That lets more people know we're here, and it gets these ideas and ways of thinking about nature and cities out into the world. The Shape of the World is a production of the Office of Modern Composition, a business that creates compositions and fosters composers. If you have a story to tell, the Office of Modern Composition can help. OMC provides coaching to writers who are working on books or other types of manuscripts. Also in February of 2023, OMC will host a writing workshop at its headquarters, downtown Chicago. Check the OMC website. There are links to it on the Shape of the World's website, or look for it on Meetup. The Shape of the World is produced in the vital, vigorous, and beautiful metropolis of Chicago in the Prairie State of Illinois. The Shape of the World is a completely carbon-neutral endeavor thanks to reductions we made and from a carbon offset purchased from Tradewater. If you're interested in eliminating your carbon footprint, go to the website tradewater.us. You can find Shape of the World on Instagram and on the website shapeoftheworldshow.com. There you'll find out more about David George Haskell's work and a drawing of him by the artist Nicole V. Hill. This episode of The Shape of the World was produced by Emily Beanblossom. Our Instagram account is managed by Ian Wenzel. The theme music is composed by Brad Wood. Special thank you today to Maya Baran and to Uleza Negron at Penguin Random House for helping to arrange the interview with David. And thanks to today's guest, David George Haskell. See you all in the spring.